You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, April 23rd, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, filmmaker Robert Greenwald on his latest film, The War on Whistleblowers. Also on the program today, you won't have Max Baucus to kick around anymore. Unless, of course, you own a big pharmaceutical lobbying firm or some other lobbying firm that he is bound to end up at. Announces his retirement before he can get primaried. Also on the program today, Boy Scouts from last week moving into the 21st century. George Bush, GW, that's a comeback. Don't call it a comeback. Just call it a came back. God, I'm just never went away. Also on the program, Ted Cruz brings hypocrisy to a new high. Mark Sanford brings hubris to a new high. Jeff Flake brings hubris to a new boy. I'll tell you, it's like the hubris show. Don't call it a comeback. And more on the Boston Marathon bombing. The suspect has now been Mirandized, and he will be tried as a civilian in a civilian court, much to the chagrin of a couple of Republican lawmakers, but not, apparently, to the vast majority of the American public. And kudos to them. In the meantime, yesterday was the final day for public comments on the Keystone XL pipeline. Over a million public comments were submitted. Presumably, most of those against the granting of a permit by the State Department and the Obama administration for this pipeline to cross the Canadian-American border. One of those comments came from the EPA, and it rated as a final parting shot. Remember now, the State Department was charged with drafting an environmental impact statement, a DEIS, which basically found, according to the State Department, that the Keystone XL pipeline would have minor effects on the environment. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, I guess one could say in the government, the real professionals on that accord, in their public comment, rated the adequacy of the State Department's draft environmental impact statement as having insufficient information. The agency could have rated the adequacy of the impact statement in three different ways: adequate, insufficient information or inadequate. Like I said, they rated it insufficient information. They said that the DEIS's attempt to do a life cycle analysis of the pipeline's emissions, which found that emissions from the oil sands crude, basically a form of bitumen, would be 81% higher than regular crude. And the EPA noted that if the GHG intensity of oil sands crude is not reduced over a 50-year period, the additional CO2 from the oil sands crude transported by the pipeline could be as much as 935 million metric tons. In other words, saying that the State Department's study was grossly underestimating the potential for additional CO2. It also said that it disagreed with the State Department's assessment that the oil sands would surely come out of the ground, the tar sands oil would surely come out of the ground even if the Keystone Pipeline was not built. The EPA said that your conclusion is not as complete and accurate as possible. It says that you used outdated modeling and the expense and infeasibility of rail shipping as an alternative to Keystone both need to be considered. It also said that the State Department's analysis did not take seriously or accurately portray the difficulty that is involved in a cleanup in the event that this tar sands oil has some form of leak or spill. It also addressed the issue of threats to drinking water as the pipeline wound its way down from north to south through the United States. So the EPA got their last licks in too, as did over 1 million people. There was a concerted effort by environmental groups to get these comments out there. 1 million people is a lot of people to comment on anything that involves other than just sitting on their couch and staring at their TV. So hopefully this will have an impact. Don't hold your breath, but hope springs eternal. I just knocked on wood. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I will be talking to Robert Greenwald about his latest film from Brave New Films. We have a link at majority.fm where you can actually get a copy of the film for free if, on your honor, you agree to hold some type of screening to give the film wide dissemination. This is a pre-recorded interview I did just about an hour ago, so it is still warm in the can, as it were. Folks, also a great time to remind you that it is your support which makes this show possible. You can become a member at majority.fm. We continue to have members who are unable to maintain their memberships, people who write and ask for memberships, and we work out a deal with them because they don't have the financial means. They've just lost a job. They've suffered some type of medical problem. A relative has suffered a medical problem. They have to take care of them, whatever it is. So if you do have the financial means to support this program, not only will you have access to another 50 minutes a day of programming, but you'll ensure that this show can continue, and you will ensure that the quality of the show can continue to grow. The more resources we have, the less time I got to spend on fixing PayPal, frankly, or doing busy work, and the more that we can craft a show for you, the more we can spend time we can spend on booking guests and whatnot. So your support is very much needed. You can become a member today. It's very easy, and it's not terribly costly, 33 cents a day. at majority.fm. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Robert Greenwald. Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Robert Greenwald. He is, of course, the founder of Brave New Films and the director and producer of his latest, War on Whistleblowers, Free Press in the National Security State. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam. Good to be with you again.
Now, Robert, you know, we've talked a lot on this program about this ongoing war on whistleblowers, more specifically with the folks from the NSA over the years who have blown the whistle in various capacities. You cover in this film one of those people, Thomas Drake, who was at the NSA, but you also cover three other folks who have also experienced the same attacks, essentially, that we have seen that have become, in many respects, a hallmark of the Obama administration. Just for a second, give us the sort of the broad perspective on that the Obama administration has taken towards whistleblowers.
Well, sadly, what we're seeing is that administrations come and go, but the power and strength of the national security state perseveres. The national security state believes in secrecy. It does everything to increase secrecy. And the Obama administration, in many ways, is the latest, you could almost say, victim of the national security state efforts. And what the film tries to do is, in all our films, whether it's, you know, Walmart or Koch Brothers or the war films, is connect the dots. And the dots here, not in a conspiracy fashion, but in a very upfront, available fashion, crackdown on whistleblowers, driven by the national security state with all its incredible power, influencing and impacting the Obama administration. And then what we also have in the film, which was sort of a surprise to me, was every single whistleblower told a similar story, which is they tried to work through channels. They tried to do what their institutions told them to do if they saw something. They came up against a dead end. And then they reached out to these amazing investigative reporters who got the attention that the stories deserve.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, we know that Thomas Drake went to the special investigator for the Inspector General for the NSA. They and all of their claims were vindicated. So these are not people who have supposedly whistleblowed on anything that wasn't perfectly legitimate. Let's take, for instance, Franz Geil. Tell us of tell us the story of Franz Geil.
Well, here's a guy who literally saved lives by insisting that the Marines look at the procurement of the vehicles in Iraq, and he insisted that there was the safer, better vehicle, the MRAP. Turned out to be accurate. He went public. He used the media to get attention, and ultimately you had then Senator Biden and the head of the Marines changing around the ordering of vehicles so that those that would save lives were actually brought in. And, you know, it's an amazing feeling. I've talked to Franz, and you see him in the movie, and we've talked to Tom Vanderbrook from the USA Today who helped get the story out there that this is a perfect example of why you should not be punishing whistleblowers, why we should be encouraging them. And frankly, again, the only way we're going to know about some of the waste, fraud, abuse, corruption, breaking of laws in national security is with whistleblowers going to journalists.
You know, it's interesting because his case in some respects is, I don't know if it's necessarily unique, but it's different in many respects than the others. I mean, I remember when this story, I was on the radio talking about this story when it broke in USA Today. This Marine ended up losing his job, but getting it back. And in many respects, you know, it's because I think it was the nature of the story. It was so digestible, so sort of clear cut, and got such wide exposure that he was able to get a lot of public support that essentially made it politically toxic to continue to attack him as a whistleblower.
Well, I mean, let's think about this for a minute. This is literally the land of Kafka. A guy goes out, does exactly what we would hope everyone should do, which is, I can save lives. I can save lives of Marines. I am a Marine. He saves lives of Marines, and he gets punished for it. It's outrageous. It's, you know, it defies words in some ways. Fortunately, as you say, it was turned around. He's got his job back. Franz participated in one of the premieres we had of the film in New York, and he was on a panel. He's incredible. You should have him on the show, by the way. He's incredibly eloquent and really makes clear how important, fundamentally important, this issue is.
Let's talk about Michael DeCourt. He was a project manager at Lockheed Martin. They were making ships for the Coast Guard, and they were apparently, well, I mean, tell us the story, because it's sort of amazing, this level of I don't know if it's just incompetence or cost-cutting or what, but tell us the story.
Well, again, as DeCourt says on 60 Minutes, and we use that clip in the film, the radios that were made to go on ships, where do ships go? Ships go in the water. The radios were not waterproof. I mean, just let's take that in for a minute or two. And Michael, to his credit, spoke up loudly and clearly. And again, you're speaking up against an ideology. I think it's important to understand the larger context. You're speaking up against an ideology around security equals secrecy, which is, of course, wrong. And as we discussed on one of the panels in New York, you know, far, far more lives have been saved by whistleblowers than by trying to keep secrets, literally lives saved. So you have, you know, you have the national security state and its ideology, and then you have the profit motive, as we see right, over and over again. Large corporations don't want the secrets coming out. They don't want to look bad, and they're choosing profit over patriotism.
Yeah, I mean, I think this story, and we should say, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but these radios are not in the on the deck of a huge ship that is, you know, that is inside a cabin. These are literally on, you know, boats that are like big Boston whalers. I mean, there's no way you could contemplate doing this unless it was just, hey, this is a great way for us to save money. And of course, when you expose this, the issue isn't that you're somehow giving some type of material comfort to our enemies in knowing that we don't have waterproof radios. This is really completely about the abuse of the secrecy regime to protect somebody's profit margin.
Well, that's exactly right. It's the profit margin. It's keeping secrets. And as Dana Priest, the top flight investigative reporter, says, the national security state is like a self-licking ice cream cone. Its concern is itself. Its concern is how it looks. It's a concern both about keeping secrets and, as everybody will know, and as everyone's had an experience with a middle-level bureaucrat of some kind who's much more interested in looking good than doing the right thing.
Right.
Or following some strange rule that doesn't make any sense.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, and this is also, this dynamic is also, I think, really at the heart of what happened to Thomas Drake and those other whistleblowers at the NSA. There was a system in place prior to 9/11 that could have easily functioned. They believe may have been able to put the pieces together in terms of those perpetrators of the terrorist attacks. It was thrown out and junked for a far more expensive boondoggle that was privately contracted. And the suspicion is that the reason why they were pursued so heavily was less about blowing the whistle on some type of national security apparatus, but more ultimately blowing it on a really unnecessary expenditure and outsourcing and privatizing of this function that never worked.
Right, exactly. That the fact that we point out in the movie, and I don't know if your listeners are aware of that, that literally the Espionage Act, meant to catch spies, is being used against whistleblowers, is staggering. And that's one of the first things that got my attention and got us to do the film. And I hope that your listeners will be able to get copies. By the way, we're offering free copies if you go to waronwhistleblowers.com for people who will get a copy on our system only and have a screening or a house party at school or work or, you know, any and every place, because we've had a generous donor who believes in the message and wants to get the word out. And people see the film and they come away saying, I can't, you know, it's hard to quite believe that, again, this administration that so many people work for and believe in is using the horrific Espionage Act against people who are truly, truly patriots in the best sense. I mean, as again, you see in the film, they're sacrificing careers, they're sacrificing family comfort, they're sacrificing financial safety.
And the Obama administration at this point has used the Espionage Act, I believe it's at least two times more. What is it? They've used it six or seven times.
Six times, which is more total than all previous administrations put together.
It's double.
The New York Times, yeah.
It's double.
All previous administrations. Now, you can argue, you know, this point or that point, but that's, again, a fact staring us in the face that needs to be talked about. Now, why is it important? Again, right, left, center, how is our money being spent? Where is it being spent? What are the laws that are being broken? What are the moral codes that are being broken? Is the money making us safer in national security, or is it being used to profit and protect institutions? And we're not going to find out from these institutions.
And it's interesting because, you know, we have seen also now the imprisonment of the CIA agent who reported, essentially, who blew the whistle on torture. And of course, those people who engaged in the torture, who ordered the torture, and this gains even more relevance now. Last week, we saw the release of a report by the Constitution Project, headed by Asa Hutchinson and former Congressman Jones, which said unequivocally that we tortured, unequivocally that it was systemic, unequivocally that it came from the highest levels of the U.S. government, speaking of the Bush administration. And yet, none of those people have faced any accountability. There is a wide consensus in this country that torture is wrong. Certainly, by all legal standards, it is illegal. Yet the whistleblower is in jail. I mean, what? And you also tell the story, I should say, of Thomas Tam, who worked at the Justice Department and essentially provided the whistleblowing on the illegal NSA wiretapping that was taking place, the warrantless wiretapping. So, all right. So we have like almost two different types of whistleblowers that are being attacked here. Some that are revealing the overreach of the government in terms of our civil liberties, and some that are basically just coming out and saying, "Hey, there's a tremendous amount of fraud or waste going on here." In both instances, we're seeing the security and secrecy apparatus used against them. I mean, this, I think, you know, your analogy of a middle manager is quite apt. I mean, I think everyone here can understand that if their boss had some type of secret code at their company. You know, I work at Verizon, and we have a national Verizon secrecy doctrine. We're going to use that anytime you start telling people that I'm taking 3-hour lunches to get drunk or something. That's basically what we're seeing here in many respects.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And so, I mean, what do you think? You mentioned that you expressed that in some ways the Obama administration is a victim of this national security apparatus. Is it growing? I mean, what's happening that the Obama administration and Obama, who came into office at least expressing a problem with these issues of warrantless wiretapping and secrecy and wanted more transparency, what is happening to that apparatus that it actually seems to be gaining exponentially more power?
Well, it's a couple of interlocking things. One is its size and scope, as we say in the film, and Dana Priest and Bill Arkin in their groundbreaking series of articles and books point out, the National Security State monitors routinely 1.6 billion, billion emails every day. National Security State has buildings the size of 3 pentagons put together. And on and on and on. So that's, a mere indicator of its size. You would think, well, a president comes in and he can do whatever he wants. Well, part of our job, as we've seen from our friends in the immigrant and the LGBT community, is to push the president. This is an issue that he needs pushing on. Dana Priest, Jane Mayer talk in the film about the president getting too close to the CIA, taking his job on as being in alignment with the CIA rather than understanding and realizing that these secrets are not going to make us safer. You know, he does take his job seriously. We may disagree with him a lot about being commander, making our country safer. But keeping these secrets in no shape or form of any kind makes us safer. It has the opposite effect. And that's why in the film, we have people across the political spectrum calling this issue out.
And you also spend a lot of time in the film talking to a lot of journalists who, lest we discuss the chilling effect that it's taken on journalists. And I don't think people really fully grasp that. Talk a little bit about that, because you mentioned in the film the sort of the legal issues that James Risen is having. We hear from a lot of different journalists that this is actually having a real impact on not just the sort of the wholesale level in terms of the whistleblowers, but on the retail level of the journalists.
Yeah, well, the journalists, as I was saying before, are critical to get the message out. Without them, we wouldn't hear about these stories. They would die a death within the institutions. So the journalists are critical, and what the journalists tell us, and we've got an amazing group of journalists who are not in the habit of speaking out, by the way, because they, journalists don't advocate. And one of the things I hope people will do with the film will be to screen it and use it to advocate. So we have Jane Mayer from The New Yorker and Dana Priest from The Washington Post and Mike Issachar from MSNBC and David Carr and Bill Keller from The New York Times and Cy Hirsch, who, everybody knows and should know. And each of them talks in different ways, in different language, different experiences about the effect that this crackdown has, that it's harder to get sources on the phone. It's harder to talk to people. Jane talked about doing a story and, having to fly around the country and strange hotel rooms to interview people because of the level of fear that's engendered when they come after you. Tom Drake, as you've mentioned, was cited under the Espionage Act.
And of course, you cover how these whistleblowers' lives have been ruined, and the legal bills that a lot of these journalists deal with. Let me ask you: do you think that there is more paranoia within this national security apparatus, in some respects, because a whistleblower today has far more avenues to get the message out, is less isolated from the public in some respects than they were even 10 years ago? I mean, I'm thinking specifically of it was DeCourt's, I guess it was DeCourt's YouTube. Yeah. And this provides a sort of, I guess, an avenue for whistleblowers that didn't exist 10 years ago.
Yes, well, that's true. There definitely are avenues and ways to get it out, but those same avenues also exist for the national security state, for the FBI, and for others to spy, listen, crack down, gain access to your emails and your phone calls. So it's definitely works both ways. There's,
right.
You know, there are opportunities to get things out, and there is the fear that they can find you and track you no matter where and how.
I mean, I guess I'm thinking of that fateful scene at the end of the 3 Days of the Condor where Max von Sydow
yeah.
says to Robert Redford, you tell them a story, speaking of the Times, but how do you know they print it? What
right.
will happen to you if they don't print it? Today,
yes,
Robert Redford would say, then I'll put it on YouTube and
yep.
Send it to BuzzFeed.
Yes, that's absolutely the good news. The problem is they're trying to scare people into not using those sources mm. and those possibilities that are available to get the word out.
And let me ask you, Robert, I mean, we've, you know, I've interviewed you many times over the years. I mean, since you, you know, and I think people know that you used to be that you used to make more entertainment-based films. I mean, you did the Steal This Movie, the Abbie Hoffman film. So you clearly always had, you know, some sort of political interest and proclivities. And in fact, I don't know if you remember. I know I've told you the story on air, but I was very close to getting the reporter role. But apparently you put a Canadian in there to shoot it up in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Now,
yes.
We've talked about it in the past. I've let
yeah,
that go.
Worst professional mistake I've made.
Yes, I understand. But we're both living with the implications
yeah.
of it. But, I mean, as you've done now almost like 8, I think it is, documentaries since that time. And has your perspective on our politics changed in terms of what you see is the fundamental problems that we're dealing with?
I think I've become more aware of the systemic structural issues the more I work on the films and the more that we try to connect the dots, then the dots jump out at us more. And I don't think it's clearer and clearer to me that it's not a question of electing individual candidates. It is a question of social movements that create the change, that pressure the candidates, no matter who they are, and the social movements that take on the structural issues of economic inequality, of the wars and how we get into them, of what our society has become. And I'm thrilled to have been able to make these films, and as long as the support continues from listeners, we have small funders, big funders, and foundations. The amazing, amazing team at Brave New Films Foundation, you know, we have plans to continue to do more of these, which continue to say, this is how it works. And I think that's something in the, you know, in an insane media environment that's sadly lacking. This is how it works. This leads to this, leads to this. And so that, you know, the best emails I get are tweets that I get over and over again are people appreciative of being able to understand something better. And from the understanding, I think, comes action.
Robert Greenwald from Brave New Films at bravenewfilms.org. We will put a link up to your latest film, The War on Whistleblowers. And I'm sorry, I had it right in front of me. The War on Whistleblowers, Free Press, and the National Security State. And again, folks, we're going to put a link up. And Brave New Films is offering you the DVD for free if, on your honor, you will basically hold a screening so that more people can see the film. It's a very important film. It's and I appreciate your taking the time to talk to us about it today, Robert.
Thank you, Sam. It's great to be back on the air with you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break, head into the better half of the program. You can call this program and be a part of it at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We can discuss anything you would like during that time in the better half of the program. I will talk about George Bush's comeback, the Bush Museum and Freedom Center, I think it's called. I'm not joking. Is opening shortly, if it hasn't opened already. I have no immediate plans to visit it, although... What's that?
That's surprising.
That I have no plans to visit it?
Yeah, I actually think a Cedar visit to the Bush Museum would be very interesting. You could test your own decision-making capacity.
Well, let's don't tip the
foreshadowing.
Yes, there you go. And maybe what we'll do is maybe it would be fun. I don't know if I could actually do this because I think Nick would probably beat me up if I tried to. But maybe over the course of the summer or something, then maybe we can see if listeners want to send me down there and record my experience at the Bush Museum in Texas. Maybe I would do that just for the, I don't know. But of course, now we are subject to a whole series of articles because Bush has got on the phone with his publicist and it's time for me to get off the couch, get some support for this museum, get people to come visit it. Also, in the better half, we will talk about Mark Sanford, who turns out to be the most pathologically narcissistic, not politician, person, I think, perhaps in the United States. I mean, just stunning. Jeff Flake, Ted Cruz, coming in with a huge bout of hypocrisy that they will, of course, not be accountable for in any fashion. Max Baucus leaving the Senate this year in a surprise announcement. I still think it's a function of him. There was that New York Times piece the other day that reported on how there is no single senator or politician who has more ex-staffers working as lobbyists than Max Baucus. And I think he just picked up the paper and just said, wait a second. I got to get some of this. I got to get on some of this sweet cashola. I mean, if my staffers can make this, can you imagine what I could make? All right, we're going to take a break. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. Also, if you buy your crap, your Amazon crap, through our Amazon link, you can find it at majority.fm/support-the-show. We got a link, support the show, at the top of the page. Click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, and whenever you got to buy your crap on Amazon, just click that bookmark, go there. You won't notice a difference. We get a little kickback.
We are less than 100 subscribers away from 20,000 YouTube subscribers.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. So if you're not already a subscriber to our YouTube channel, it is absolutely free. YouTube.com/Sam Cedar. Let's get to 20,000 this week.
Let's do it, folks. Do you get your news? It's certainly your kids do, right? Your nephew, your niece, your aunt, your uncle, maybe your grandparents. Tell them to subscribe to our YouTube channel. Gives you little clips you can embed on your Facebook page, in your Twitter feed, in your Friendster feed.
Instead of, you know, just telling a family member or friend about a specific story you heard on this show, you could give them the clip of that exact story.
Don't your MySpace feed.
Read through the whole show for people
who
aren't
familiar
with
it. What else? If you're still on the well? All right, folks. See you in the better half.